Right, yeah, thanks everyone for tuning in for our Friday night chat. And so I'll be giving a bit of an introduction to political comedy, joking and provoking. Comedy, as we know, can be a kind of escapism, such as when we spend the evening watching a cosy sitcom like Friends or Last of the Summer Wine or even Mrs. Brown's Boys to unwind from a frustrating day. But humour can also be a way of processing or dealing with our daily frustrations. This applies on both the small and a wider scale. For example, on the small scale, we can get through a difficult day at work by making light of it when chatting with others. And on the wider scale, humour can be a way of comprehending an absurd world we don't have much power in. This is where comedy can have a political edge. Satire is the word which springs to mind in relation to political comedy. And the comedians and programmes I'll be mentioning in this talk could all be grouped under satire if a fairly broad definition is used. Satire ridicules the traits of organisations or people in power using parody, sarcasm, irony and exaggeration, and well, maybe innuendo as well. In this way, it can highlight problems in a more memorable or vivid way than a more straightforward description. For instance, I could say, I've got a government advent calendar this year. It's like a normal advent calendar, but when you open door number 10, there's a shyster behind it. And this is more lively than just saying Keir Starmer is a shyster. Satire often just operates like a safety valve, a way of releasing the pressure of what annoys or inhibits us. And when this is felt to be enough, satire is blunted. Or to use another metaphor, it has teeth but doesn't always bite hard enough. And this accounts for why satire is very much a mainstream type of comedy. Even in the old Soviet Union, satire was allowed in the magazine Crocodile. And the satirical magazine has a very long tradition, with Punch first being published in 1841 and lasting until 2002. And of course, you know, can't really mention satirical magazines without mentioning the most readable of those, which remains Private Eye, which began in 1961 and has maintained the same format of reportage mixed with topical jokes and parodies. And Private Eye started as part of the satire boom of the 1960s. In his book, The Neophiliacs, someone called Christopher Booker says that this tendency arose because a generation of Oxbridge graduates found that the careers in the British Empire, which their forebears enjoyed, were no longer there for them. And so instead they turned to question the status quo. Luminaries of the 60s satire boom include ex-SPGB-er John Bird, Paul Foote of the SWP, David Frost, Peter Cook, John Fortune, and later members of Monty Python, the Two Ronnies, and the Goodies. And perhaps I should mention that I'll be sticking to British comedy in this talk and ignoring that from other countries, although there's enough material about Soviet comedy beyond Crocodile magazine to discuss. And a talk focusing on American comedy would be interesting, with figures such as George Carlin, who was dubbed the Dean of Counterculture Comedians, Maverick Lenny Bruce, and singer Tom Lehrer. And perhaps we can hear about any New Zealand comics a bit later on as well. And the 60s satire boom lent itself well to television, such as sketches in the programme That Was the Week That Was, which ran from 1962 to 1963. And this programme took a wry look at current affairs and lampooned famous figures. And some of its content is difficult to watch now in the same way as viewers at the time would have watched it, such as a sketch parodying the then current black and white minstrel show in response to the murder of a campaigner against racial segregation. And a successor to this programme, That Was the Week That Was, I mean, not the black and white minstrel show, was the Frost Report, helmed by David Frost. And this included one of the most well-known examples of political comedy, and I'm sure a lot of us know the sketch I'm about to mention, which is the class sketch from 1966. And this is the one with Ronnie Barker dressed in a suit saying, "I look up to him, John Cleese wearing a bowler hat, because he is upper class. But I look down on him, Ronnie Corbett wearing a cloth cap, because he is lower class." And Corbett replying with, "I know my place." And in this sketch, Ronnie Barker represents a middle class and Ronnie Corbett represents the lumpen proletariat. So, this sketch doesn't really fit in with the explanation of only two classes in society, although it could be said that the sketch is more about perceptions of class than economic circumstances. And there are several different versions of this sketch. And I think the 1960s ones, I think they're all written by Ronnie Barker. And the most recent one version was performed by John Cleese in, I think, 2017, being produced for the group Hacked Off as part of their campaign for improved standards of journalism. And John Cleese, of course, was part of another famous political sketch, one which, I'm sure a fair few of us are familiar with, and that's a fairly short scene in the 1979 film Monty Python's Life of Brian, where members of the People's Front of Judea are complaining about the Judean People's Front. And as we know, this is often quoted to refer to similarities between factions of the left. And John Cleese's own political views have shifted over time. And he's most often seen these days discussing these than for being a comedian. He was previously a supporter of the Liberal Democrats. He's declined a peerage and was pro-Brexit and anti-Trump. Recently, he's been critical of immigration and cancel culture. And he's been a victim of this himself through criticism of the use of racist language and anti-German sentiment in Fawlty Towers. That's not to say Fawlty Towers is a racist or an anti-German sitcom, in my view, but there has been criticism of language used in it. And cancel culture has also been a topic of interest for Rowan Atkinson, known especially for Blackadder and Mr. Bean. And he's campaigned against legislation criminalising or curtailing free speech if it causes offence. And in an interview with the Radio Times in 2021, Atkinson said, quote, "It's imp- I won't try and do his voice. It's important that we're exposed to a wide spectrum of opinion. But what we have now is the digital equivalent of the medieval mob roaming the streets looking for someone to burn. The problem we have online is that an algorithm decides what we want to see, which ends up creating a simplistic binary view of society. It becomes a case of either you're with us or against us. And if you're against us, you deserve to be cancelled," end quote. And what being cancelled means in practice isn't straightforward. But modern reactions to Fawlty Towers at least demonstrate that attitudes change. But there are other 70s sitcoms which are much more dated than Fawlty Towers, such as On the Buses or one called Curry and Chips. Not sure how many people have heard of that, but I think it's one of those ones where it was intended to, in a very crude 1970s way, intended to highlight ethnic diversity, but you really wouldn't think that to watch it. It contains lots of very crude stereotypes, as I'm sure you can imagine. But the new generation of alternative comedians, which emerged from the late 70s, was to some extent a reaction against the worst of that decade's comedy, fueled by remnants of punk's energy and dislike of Thatcher, of course. No mention of alternative comedy would be complete without mentioning Thatcher. And Rowan Atkinson was part of this wave and became well known through the satirical sketch show Not the 9 o'clock News. And another figure whose career began then has, unlike Atkinson, sort of mellowed in recent years. Alexei Sale has a more relaxed style these days than the manic persona which he gained fame with as one of the comic strip collective. And in his youth, Alexis Sale was a member of the Young Communist League and the Communist Party of Britain, Marxist-Leninist, and later became a supporter of Jeremy Corbyn, and in so doing was accused of anti-Semitism. His act over the years has thrown in references to communism quite often, but his comedy isn't really intended to change people's minds. An example of Sale's humour is his routine about American phrases. And so here's a quote. If you travel to the States, they have a lot of different words than like what we use. For instance, they say elevator, we say lift. They say drapes, we say curtains. They say president, we say seriously deranged git. The brashness of 80s comedy is perhaps best shown in A Spitting Image, which was broadcast on ITV from 1984 to 1996, with a short-lived and now forgotten revival in 2020 and 2021. And in Spitting Image, as we know, puppets of popular figures exaggerated their traits to show clearer their characters' characteristics. Thatcher was portrayed as a dead-eyed, abusive tyrant. John Major was grey, and Edwina Curry was a vampire. Its sketches were derisive, cynical, and especially importantly, funny. And one sketch from its late 80s heyday has Secretary of State Cecil Parkinson ending a cabinet meeting by saying, do we have any other business? To which Thatcher replies, I bloody well hope not, we've sold it all off. The 80s wave of political comedy was more irreverent and less elitist than that of the 60s satire boom, being more sort of polytechnic than Oxbridge. And but the Oxbridge tendency of political comedy on television survives these days in Have I Got News For You, which has been running since 1990 with Private Eye's editor Ian Hislop as one of the panellists. And on radio, there have been similarly styled topical news satire panel programmes such as Radio 4's The Now Show, which I think has been replaced recently by one called The Naked Week. And as well as sketch shows and panel shows, a type of comedy suited to television is the sitcom. And labelling a show as a sitcom can make us assume that it'll be throwaway or shallow, however watchable. But some of the most well-known situation comedies have said something about society and how we cope with it. The situation in Only Fools and Horses, for example, is trying to win at capitalism with a wheeler-dealer lifestyle. And party political sitcoms include the BBC's Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister, which together span most of the 80s with a revival in 2013. Like with Spitting Image, you know, this had a revival which, again, obviously tried to sort of tap into its previous popularity, but seems to be sort of forgotten about now, which perhaps shows that, TV viewing habits have changed a bit since then, but. There's something very sort of 80s about Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister and Spitting Image, which hasn't really been sort of recaptured even when they've tried to resurrect these shows in more recent years. Excuse me, I just need to wet my whistle. Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister highlighted the convoluted bureaucracy and power games in government while avoiding mentioning which party the characters were in. It was never said whether the figures in that were supposed to be Tory or Conservative, Tory or Labour, or Liberal Democrat, for all we know. And that the scripts work whether the government depicted was Labour or Conservative shows that the machinery is what guides politics. But the writer's intention was a bit different, though. Co-writer Jonathan Lynn said, quote, in Yes Minister, we showed that almost everything that the government has to decide is a conflict between two lots of private interest, that of the politicians and that of the civil servants trying to advance their own careers and improve their own lives. And that's why public choice economics, which explains why all of this was going on, was at the root of almost every episode of Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister, end quote. I hadn't heard of public choice economics before this, but it concerns how people behave when in positions of power, particularly how much they're driven by self-interest. And while Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister explored this notion in quite a sedate BBC kind of way, its ITV counterpart took a much more direct approach. I'm here talking about the sitcom The New Statesman, which ran from 1987 to 1994. And this centred around the vile Tory and later Labour MP Alan Bastard, played by Rick Mail. And Rick Mail came from the same alternative comedy scene as Alexei Sale. Alan Bastard's career as an MP involves backing policies which he can use to further his own position, such as campaigning for the reintroduction of the death penalty so he can award himself the contract to build gallows. And in this century, we've also had quite a few politically edged sitcoms. We've had The Thick of It, which ran between 2005 and 2012. And that sent up the games played by politicians, civil servants and government advisers. In some ways, it's a more sort of sweary version of Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister, and starred Peter Capaldi, I think. 2012, which was made by the same people, I think, and sort of very much of the sort of same kind of tone, that ran 2011 to 2012, and also one called W1A, 2014 to 2015. And these satirise the corporate culture behind the London Olympics and the BBC. And their sort of mockumentary style was influenced by the sitcom The Office, which ran from 2001 to 2003. And that was quite perceptive about workplace dynamics. As was another sitcom called Getting On from 2012 and its 2016 sequel Going Forward. And in these two series, Joe Brand's character, Kim, works in a geriatric ward of an NHS hospital and then as a home carer, and having to wade through the swamp of market forces and stifling procedures to care for her patients. So it's very much sort of deadpan, bedpan humour for that one. But my favourite example of what could loosely be called political comedy is a sitcom which has a more ambitious reach than those which I've mentioned so far, and even goes so far as to critique some of the fundamentals of capitalism. I'm talking about The Fall and Rise of Reginald Perrin, which ran from the BBC, which ran on the BBC from 1976 to 1979, and was adapted for television by David Nobbs from his novels, and starred the legendary Leonard Rossiter in the title role. In the first series, Reginald Perrin tires of the routines and hierarchies of being a middle-aged middle manager working for Sunshine Desserts. And so he stages his own suicide to try and live life as a free spirit. And I didn't get where I am today without recognising that there aren't many better descriptions of the alienation of corporate and suburban life than this. In the second series, Reginald Perrin establishes a company called Grot, which sells deliberately useless commodities, such as upright models of the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and the ideal gift for the motorist you don't like, the elastic tow rope. Although he sets up the enterprise as a comment on the hollowness of consumerism, this ends up making it highly profitable. So Grot and Reginald Perrin become a victim of their own success. The third series, had the main characters all live together in a commune called Perrins, which they wanted as a sort of a model for wider society. And an advert for the Perrins commune is want to drop out but don't like dropouts? At Perrins, the dropouts are just like you. They're more like drop-ins. So next time you feel like dropping out, why not drop in? And this instalment tapped into the same 70s vibe for alternative lifestyles, which was explored in self-sufficiency sitcom The Good Life, which has again a bit more of a political edge behind it than might first be apparent. Especially the last episode of The Good Life, where the sort of self-sufficiency in suburbia lifestyle comes to a halt when the home is vandalized, which is quite a sort of a shift in tone, really, and it sort of brings the sitcom right down to a sort of a grinding halt in a sort of quite a perceptive way. But anyway, I'm going off on a tangent. With The Fall and Rise of Reginald Perrin, there was actually a fourth series, which was quite disappointing, unfortunately. It was made in 1996 and featured the main characters with the notable lack of Reginald Perrin himself, organising a government takeover by senior citizens. The programmes I've mentioned have all been group efforts, of course, with the end product being the work of writers, actors, designers, directors, and so on. But conversely, stand-up comedy is just one person talking to an audience, and this is more, sort of direct and more personal, and therefore is more sort of obviously opinionated than comedy, which has been made collectively. And remember that comedy has a target, something we laugh at. An example which has become a sort of an archetype of comedy is someone slipping on a banana skin. And this is a situation where something bad happens to someone else, and our immediate reaction is to find it funny. But what differentiates this from just cruelly laughing at someone falling over is the banana skin, which gives the situation a slightly ridiculous aspect, which makes it funny. I'll be returning to my banana skin metaphor a bit further on. But when a joke targets the person who falls over rather than the act of falling over, it can easily veer into making personal attacks on groups. And we find this in the routines of right-wing comedians. Right-wing comedy used to be associated with tacky social clubs of the 1970s, where an overweight man with sideburns would tell gags about the Irish, people from Pakistan, and his mother-in-law. And some figures which represent this type of comedy have had long-term mainstream success, such as Bernard Manning. Although by the 1980s, he was seen less on television, but continued with his same act live. Jim Davidson, OBE, has had primetime TV slots as a presenter while maintaining a career as a right-wing comic with derogatory jokes about, among others, gay people and rape survivors. And he's still very visible online and as a pundit. He's been a Freemason, a supporter of the Tories, and in 2015 he said, "UKIP are the Jim Davidson of the political world," which was supposed to be a compliment. And while Jim Davidson is one of the last of the old guard of right-wing comedian, there's recently been a new generation, and these are, younger, media savvy, and they perform live stand-up as well as producing online vlogs, being pundits, and occasionally getting on TV. Someone called Jeff Norcott is maybe the most visible of this type of new right-wing comedian, and he appears quite a lot on the BBC, and his output plays on his blokish identity as a Tory voting right-wing libertarian, which is how he's described himself. Another person called Leo Kurz is more prominent online, live and occasionally on TV, but that tends to be these sort of fringe channels like Talk TV, GB News, that kind of thing. And he's further to the right than Northcott, and his routines are as much about pushing his political viewpoint as about jokes. His main target is wokeness, as he would see it, especially in the media, and with some gags about gay people and fat activists, in quotes. And you know, he doesn't come across as a nice person at all. And he, like other right wingers, has a tone which is confidently sarcastic and patronising, with an affected whiny delivery, especially when he's referring to, as he would see it, woke people. So I'm yet to find a right wing comedian with any warmth about them, and I really don't think I will. Left wing comedians, even if you don't agree with their politics, tend to sound like nicer people than right wing ones. And this is often true for left and right wingers who aren't comedians, of course. But the difference is that a comedian has a heightened persona, so their traits are more obvious. Right wing comedians like to punch down by criticizing groups which they feel superior to. And left-wing comedians don't tend to do this, and instead sort of punch up at organisations. So with the banana skin situation, then if a right-wing comedian laughs at the person who slipped over, a left-wing comedian will focus on how the banana skin is the problem. Left-wing comedians still outnumber right-wing ones, and two of the most well-known are Mark Steele and Mark Thomas. And they both have an amiable conversational delivery, with their material being a blend of investigative journalism and stand-up. Mark Steele has supported the SWP, the People's Assembly, the Green Party, and in 2000 he himself stood as a candidate in the London Assembly elections for the London Socialist Alliance. And he's presented many radio programmes, especially on the BBC. His 1990s radio series, The Mark Steele Solution, had the format where, as described by Wikipedia, each episode presents persuasive yet witty arguments for a seemingly bizarre solution to a contemporary social problem by highlighting the flaws in the present system. And examples include transport should only be paid for by people who don't use it, and people should have to change their religion every Monday. Not quite sure. I should listen to the programs and see what see how those arguments are played out. Of course, you know, it's only sort of tongue in cheek, but at least, you know, it sort of gets people to think. Mark Thomas has been best known for his for the political stunts he performed on his show, The Mark Thomas Comedy Product, on Channel 4, which ran from 1996 to 2003. He's also investigated human rights violations by Coca-Cola in Colombia and loopholes in arms trading laws. Mark Thomas described himself as a libertarian anarchist in 1999. In an interview in The Guardian, but he later became involved with the parliamentary system. For his tour in 2009, which was called It's the Stupid Economy, he encouraged the audience each show to come up with their own policies, silly or serious, that would somehow make their lives better. And these suggestions of policies formed his People's Manifesto, which, you know, that they're all collated and put together in a manifesto. And then he announced a competition to find someone to stand in the 2010 general election with their campaign based on the manifesto's policies. And the winner of the contest, someone called Danny Kushlick, stood in Bristol West and finished sixth out of seven candidates. And a couple of the manifesto's policies include there should be a public referendum before going to war, and the introduction of a maximum wage. Mark Thomas, he later backed the Green Party and Labour under Jeremy Corbyn. Quite a few of the people here, quite a few of the comedians I'll be mentioning have backed Corbyn at one point or another. Another left-wing comedian, Rob Newman, his stance has similarities to that of Mark Thomas. In 2001, he called for a boycott of the Perrier Comedy Award because Perrier is owned by Nestle, who market powdered baby milk in developing countries. And Apocalypso Now was the title of his show, which mixed stand-up comedy with a lecture on geopolitics and peak oil. And elsewhere, Rob Newman has been politically active with Reclaim the Streets, the Liverpool Dockers, Indie Media, and an organisation called People's Global Action. Another left-wing comic, Joe Lycett, his act has included a routine criticising water pollution, and he often voices support for the LGBTQ plus community. One clip of his, which is worth watching, it's sort of cringe comedy, really. In 2022, so only a couple of years ago, he appeared on an edition of the BBC's politics show, Sunday with Laura Koonsberg, which also featured Liz Truss. And throughout this, he deadpan joked that he was very right-wing and agreed with Truss's policies in order to send them up. Another time, he temporarily changed his name to Hugo Boss to draw attention to that company's use of legal action against small businesses with the word boss in their name. Josie Long, she's mostly known for stand-up comedy alongside protesting against public sector government funding cuts. And she's also a long-term proponent of the anti-tax avoidance activist group UK Uncut. Ricky Gervais has had a varied career in stand-up, show running, acting and presenting, and also finding the time to support Jeremy Corbyn and advocate for animal rights and humanism. His act can be much, much spikier than most comedians, particularly in how he's called out hypocrisy and privilege. So, yeah, to sort of round off, yeah, while there's plenty of choice if you're looking for politically driven stand-up comedians, this choice is along the left-right spectrum. Perhaps the most radical in some sense of the word is someone called Stuart Lee, who's, I mean, his comedy is quite meta and self-referential, and it's a bit pretentious because of it. Although, again, it sort of makes you think. He sort of deconstructs things. So, yeah, his shows are a bit like a sort of a, I don't know, sort of like a media studies lecture at times. But again, he makes you think. He's got sort of a fresh view on things. And although he's more widely known for Jerry Springer, the opera, which faced criticisms of blasphemy when that was first performed just over 20 years ago. But I'm yet to find a genuine revolutionary or socialist comedian. Although their act wouldn't necessarily start off too differently from some of the material I've already mentioned, you know, some of the stand-up routines or, you know, material in Private Eye or Spitting Image. But of course, you know, revolutionary or socialist comedians would have to find jokes, you know, with a different perspective and a different punchline. So returning to the banana skin, if a right-wing comic laughs at the person who slips over and a left-wing comic complains about the banana skin, then I suppose a socialist comedian would ridicule the system which meant the streets were littered with fruit. And as for what comedy would be like in a socialist society, I'm not sure I can imagine. But I'm hoping that people would still be watching The Fall and Rise of Reginald Perrin. There you go. Yeah, thanks very much for listening. And yeah, I'll hope to hear some political gags from yourselves as well. Yeah, thank you very much. Cheers.